I have a diplomat in Rakerga, Varana continued. He can make the overtures to King Urgot. Do we know anything useful about the King of the Murkos?
Yes, Porin said firmly. He will be amenable to the suggestion.
And how do you know, Your Majesty? Porin hesitated.
I would rather not say, she said with a quick glance at Javelin. Just take my word for it.
Of course, Varana agreed. Vella rose and walked to the window, her satin gown filling the room with its music.
You people of the West always want to complicate things, she said critically. Zakath's your problem. Send somebody to Malzeth with a sharp knife.
You should have been a man, Vella, Unheg laughed. She turned and looked at him with smoldering eyes.
Do you really think so?
Well, he hesitated. Maybe not. She leaned disconsolately against the window casing.
Oh, I wish I had my juggler here to entertain me. Politics always give me a headache,
she sighed.
I wonder whatever happened to him.
Porin smiled, watching the girl intently and remembering the sudden insight she had when the Nadrak girl first arrived in Boktor.
Would you be terribly disappointed to find out that your juggler was not who he seemed to be?
She asked.
Galgarath mentioned him in his letter.
Vella looked at her sharply.
Belgarath would have known him, of course,
Porin went on.
It was Beldon.
Vella's eyes went wide.
The hunched-backed sorcerer?
She exclaimed.
The one who can fly?
Porin nodded. Vella said a number of things that no genteel lady would have said. Even King Anheg turned slightly pale at her choice of language. Then she drew a dagger and advanced on Yarblek, her breath hissing between her teeth. Mandaralan, clad all in steel, stepped in front of her, and Hetar and Barak seized her from behind and wrested the knife from her grasp.
You idiot!
She shrieked at the cringing Yarblek.
You absolute idiot! You could have sold me to him!
And then she collapsed, weeping against Barak's fur-clad chest, even as Hetar prudently relieved her of her other three daggers. Zandramas, the child of Dark, stood gazing across a desolate valley where shattered villages smoked and smoldered under a lead-gray sky. The eyes of the child of Dark were hooded, and she looked unseeing at the devastation spread before her. A lusty wail came from behind her, and she set her teeth together.
Feed him,
she said shortly.
As you command, mistress,
the man with white eyes said quickly, in a mollifying tone.
Don't patronize me, Naradas,
she snapped.
Just shut the brat up. I'm trying to think.
It had been a long time. Zandramas had worked everything out so very carefully. Now she had come half around the world, and despite her best efforts, the God Slayer with his dreadful sword was but a few days behind her. The sword. The flaming sword. It filled her sleep with nightmares, and the burning face of the Child of Light terrified her even more.
How does he stay so close behind?
She exploded.
Will nothing slow him?
She thrust her hands out in front of her and turned them palms up. A myriad of tiny points of light seemed to swirl beneath the skin of her hands, swirling, glittering, like a constellation of minuscule stars spinning in her very flesh. How long would it be until those constellations invaded her entire body and she ceased even to be human? How long until the dreadful spirit of the Child of Dark possessed her utterly? The child wailed again.
I told you to shut him up,
she half shouted.
At once, mistress, Naradas said.
The Child of Dark went back to the contemplation of the starry universe, enclosed in her flesh. Eriond and Horse rode out at the first light before the others had awakened, cantering across a mountain meadow in the silvery dawn light. It was good to ride alone, to feel the surge and flow of Horse's muscles under him, and the wind against his face without the distraction of talk. He reined in atop a knoll to watch the sunrise, and that was good, too. He looked out over the sun-touched mountains of Zamad, drinking in the beauty and the solitude, then gazed at the fair sight of the bright green fields and forests. Life was good here. The world was filled with loveliness, and with people that he loved. How could Aldur have forced himself to leave all of this? Aldur had been the god who must have loved this world above all things, since he had refused to take a people to worship him, but had chosen to spend his time alone, to study this fair world. And now, he could only visit occasionally in spiritual form. But Aldur had accepted the sacrifice. Eriond sighed, feeling that perhaps no sacrifice could be truly unbearable if it were made out of love. Eriond took comfort in that belief. Then he sighed again, and slowly rode back toward the little lake and the cluster of tents where the others slept. Chapter 2 They rose late that morning. The turmoil of the past several weeks seemed finally to have caught up with Geryon, and even though he could tell by the light streaming in through the front of the tent that the sun was already high, he was reluctant to move. He could hear the clinking of Polgara's cooking utensils, and the murmur of voices. He knew he was going to have to get up soon anyway. He considered trying to doze off to catch a few last moments of sleep, but decided against it. He moved carefully to avoid waking Zenedra as he slid out from under their blankets. He leaned over and gently kissed her hair, then he pulled on his rust-colored tunic, picked up his boots and sword, and ducked out of the tent. Polgara, in her gray traveling dress, was by her cook fire. As usual, she hummed softly as she worked. Silk and Belgarath were talking quietly nearby. Silk had, for some reason, changed clothes, and he now wore the soft pearl-gray doublet, which marked him as a prosperous businessman. Belgarath, of course, still wore his rust-colored tunic, patched hose, and mismatched boots. Durnak and Toth were fishing, lacing the blue surface of the little mountain lake with their lines, and Eriond was brushing the gleaming chestnut coat of his stallion. The rest of their friends had apparently not arisen yet.
"We thought you were going to sleep all day," Belgarath said as Geryon sat on a log to pull on his boots.
"I gave it some thought," Geryon admitted. He stood up and looked across the sparkling lake. There was a grove of aspens on the far side, their trunks the color of new snow. The leaves had begun to turn. They shimmered in the morning sun like beaten gold. The air was cool and slightly damp. Suddenly, he wished that they could stay here for a few days. He sighed and walked over to join his grandfather and Silk near the fire.
"Why the fancy clothes?" he asked the rat-faced little Drasnian.
Silk shrugged.
"We're moving into an area where I'm fairly well known," he replied. "We might be able to take advantage of that, as long as people recognize me. Are you absolutely sure the trail goes toward the southeast?"
Geryon nodded.
"There was a little confusion right at the first, but I got it sorted out."
"Confusion?" Belgarath asked.
"The Sardian was here, too, a long time ago. For a few moments, the orb seemed to want to follow both trails at the same time. I had to speak with it rather firmly about that."
Geryon draped the sword belt over his shoulder and buckled it. Then he shifted the scabbard slightly until it was more comfortable. The orb on the pommel of the sword was glowing a sullen red color.
"Why is it doing that?"
Silk asked curiously.
"Because of the Sardian," Geryon told him. He looked over his shoulder at the glowing stone. "Stop that," he said.
"Don't hurt its feelings," Silk warned.
"We could be in a great deal of trouble
if it decides to start sulking."
What lies off to the southeast? Belgorath asked the little man.
Vercebo, Silk replied. There isn't much there except some caravan tracks and a few mines up in the mountains. There is a seaport at Panor. I land there sometimes on my way back from Messina.
Are the people there Karans?
Silk nodded. But they're even cruder than the ones back in the Central Kingdoms, if that's possible.
The blue-banded hawk came spiraling out of a bright morning sky, flared, and shimmered into the form of Belden as soon as the talons touched the ground. The hunchbacked little sorcerer was dressed in his usual rags, tied on with bits of thong and twigs and straw clinging to his hair and beard. He shivered.
I hate to fly when it's cold, he grumbled. Makes my wings ache.
It's not really that cold, Silk said.
Try it a couple thousand feet up.
Belden pointed toward the sky, then turned and spat out a couple of soggy gray feathers.
Grazing again, Uncle?
Balgara asked from her cook fire.
Just a bite for breakfast, Paul. There was a pigeon that got up too early this morning.
You didn't have to do that, you know.
She tapped meaningfully on the side of her bubbling pot with her long-handled wooden spoon. Belden shrugged.
The world isn't going to miss one pigeon.
Garion shuddered.
How can you stand to eat them raw like that?
You get used to it. I've never had much luck trying to build a cook fire with my talons.
He looked at Belgorath.
There's some trouble up ahead. A lot of smoke and grouped men wandering around.
Could you see who they were?
I didn't get that close. There's usually a bored archer or two in any crowd like that, and I'd prefer not to have my tail feathers parted with an arrow just because some idiot wants to show off his skill.
Has that ever happened?
Silk asked curiously.
Once, a long time ago. My hip still aches in cold weather.
Did you do something about it?
I had a chat with the archer. I asked him not to do it anymore. He was breaking his bow across his knee when I left.
He turned back to Belgorath.
Are we sure the trail goes on down to that plain?
Well, the orb is.
Well, then we'll have to chance it.
The little man looked around.
I thought you'd have struck the tents by now.
I decided it might not hurt to let everybody get some sleep. We have been traveling hard, and we are going to have to do it some more, I think.
You always want to pick these idyllic spots for your rest stops, Belgorath,
Belden observed.
I think that you are secretly a romantic.
Belgorath shrugged.
Nobody's perfect.
Garion,
Polgara called.
Yes, Aunt Paul? Why don't you wake the others? Breakfast is almost ready.
Right away, Aunt Paul. After breakfast, they broke camp and started out about mid-morning with Belden flying on ahead to scout out possible trouble. It was pleasantly warm now, and there was the pungent smell of evergreens in the air. Cenedra was strangely quiet as she rode along beside Garion with her dark gray cloak pulled tightly around her.
What's the matter, dear?
He asked her.
She didn't have Garion with her,
the little queen murmured sadly.
Zandramas, you mean?
No, she didn't, did she?
Was she really there, Garion?
In a way. But in a way she wasn't. It was sort of the way Soradus was here and not here at the same time.
I don't understand.
It was more than a projection, but less than actually being there.
We talked it over last night and Belden explained it. I didn't understand very much of what he said.
Belden's explanations get a little obscure sometimes.
He's very wise, isn't he?
Garion nodded.
But he's not a very good teacher. He gets impatient with people who can't keep up with him. Anyway, this business of being somewhere between a projection and the real thing makes Zandramas very dangerous. We can't hurt her, but she can hurt us.
She came very close to killing you yesterday, you know, until Poledra stopped her. She's very much afraid of Poledra.
That's the first time I have ever seen your grandmother.
No, actually it's not. She was there at Aunt Paul's wedding, remember? And she helped us in Ulgoland when we had to fight the Eldrak.
But one time she was an owl, and the other time she was a wolf.
In Poledra's case, I don't think that really matters.
Tinedra suddenly laughed.
What's so funny?
When this is all over and we're back home with our baby, why don't you change into a wolf for a while?
She suggested. Why?
He might be nice to have a big gray wolf lying before the fire, and then on cold nights I could burrow my feet into your fur to keep them warm.
He gave her a long, steady look.
I'd scratch your ears for you, Geryon,
she offered by way of inducement.
And get you nice bones from the kitchen to chew on.
Never mind, he said flatly.
But my feet get cold.
I've noticed.
Just ahead of them, as they rode up through a shady mountain pass, Silk and Sadi were engaged in a heated discussion.
Absolutely not, Silk said. I really think you're being unreasonable about this, Keldar, Sadi protested.
The eunuch had discarded his iridescent silk robe and now wore western-style tunic and hose and stout boots.
You have the distribution system already in place, and I have access to unlimited supplies. We could make millions.
Forget it, Sadi. I won't deal in drugs.
You deal in everything else, Keldar. There's a market out there just waiting to be tapped. Why let scruples stand in the way of business?
You're Naisen, Sadi. Drugs are a part of your culture, so you wouldn't understand.
Lady Polgara uses drugs when she treats the sick, Sadi pointed out defensively.
Oh, that's different.
I don't see how.
I could never explain it to you, Sadi sighed.
I am very disappointed in you, Keldar. You are a spy, an assassin, and a thief. You cheat at dice, you counterfeit money, and you are unscrupulous with married women. You swindle your customers outrageously, and you soak up ale like a sponge. You are the most corrupt man I have ever known, but you refuse to transport a few harmless little compounds that would make your customers very happy.
A man has to draw the line somewhere, Silk replied loftily. Velvet shifted in her saddle to look back at them.
That was one of the more fascinating conversations that I have ever heard, gentlemen,
she complimented them.
The implications in the field of comparative morality are absolutely staggering.
She gave them a sunny smile with her dimples flashing into view.
Margravine Lascelles, Sadi said. Do you happen to have Zith again?
Why, yes, Sadi. As a matter of fact, I do.
The honey blonde girl held up one hand to head off his objections.
But I didn't steal her this time. She crawled into my tent in the middle of the night and crept into her favorite hiding place all on her own. The poor dear was actually shivering.
Silk turned slightly pale.
Would you like to have her back?
Velvet asked the shaved-headed eunuch.
No,
Sadi sighed, rubbing his hand over his scalp.
I suppose not. As long as she is happy where she is, we might as well leave her there.
She's very happy. In fact, she is purring.
Velvet frowned slightly.
I think you should watch her diet. Just a bit, Sadi,
she said critically.
Her little tummy seems to be getting bigger.
She smiled again.
We wouldn't want a fat snake on our hands, would we?
Well, excuse me, Sadi said,
sounding very offended.
There was a large snag at the top of the pass, and the blue-banded hawk perched on a dead limb, busily preening his feathers with his hooked beak. As they approached, he swooped down, and Belden stood in the trail in front of them, muttering curses. "Something is wrong, Uncle?" Bulgara asked him.
"I got caught in a crosswind," he growled. "Scrambled my feathers a bit. You know how that goes."
"Oh, goodness, yes. It happens to me all the time. Night breezes are so unpredictable."
"Your feathers are too soft."
"I did not design the owl, Uncle, so don't blame me about the feathers."
"There's a crossroads tavern just up ahead," Belden said to Belgarath. "Did you want to stop and see if we can find out what's going on down there on the plain?"
"That might not be a bad idea," Belgarath agreed. "Let's not ride into trouble if we don't have to."
"I'll wait for you inside, then," Belden said, and soared away again.
Polgara sighed. "Why must it always be a tavern?" she complained.
"Because people who have been drinking like to talk, Paul," Belgarath explained in reasonable tones. "You can gather more information in 5 minutes in a tavern than you can in an hour in a tea room."
"I knew you would be able to find a reason for it."
"Naturally."
They crossed over the top of the wooded pass and on down the shade-splotched trail to the tavern. It was a low building made of logs crudely chinked with mud. The roof was low, and its shingles had curled with the weather and the passage of years. Buff-colored chickens scratched at the dirt in the dooryard, and a large speckled sow lay in a mud puddle, nursing a litter of happily grunting piglets. There were a few spivvined nags tied to a hitch rail in front of the tavern, and a Karand dressed in moth-eaten furs snored on the front stoop. Bulgara reined in her horse as they approached the tavern, and the first whiff of its reeking interior reached her nostrils.
"I think, ladies, that we might prefer to wait over there in the shade." "There is a certain fragrance coming out that door, isn't there?"
Velvet agreed.
"You too, Ariand,"
Bulgara said firmly. "There is no need for you to start picking up bad habits this early in life." She rode over toward a grove of tall fir trees some distance away from the tavern, and dismounted in the shade. Durnik and Toth exchanged a quick glance, then joined her there with Velvet, Zenedra, and Ariand. Zadi started to dismount in front of the tavern. Then he sniffed once and gagged slightly.
"This is not my sort of place, gentlemen. I think I'll wait outside as well. Besides, it is Zith feeding time."
"Suit yourself," Belgarath shrugged,
dismounting and leading the way toward the building. They stepped over the snoring Karand on the stoop and went inside.
"Split up and spread out," the old man muttered. "Circulate. Talk to as many as you can."
He looked at Silk.
"We are not here to make a career out of this," he cautioned.
"Oh, trust me," Silk said, moving away. Geryon stood just inside the door, blinking to let his eyes adjust to the dimness. The tavern showed no signs of ever having been cleaned. The floor was covered with moldy straw that reeked of spilled beer, and scraps of rotting food lay in heaps in the corners. A crudely built fireplace smoked at the far end, adding its fumes to the generally unpleasant odor of the place. The tables consisted of rough-hewn planks laid on trellises, and the benches were half-logs with sticks drilled into their undersides for legs. Geryon saw Belden talking with several Karans over in one corner, and he started over to join him. As he passed one of the tables, his foot came down on something soft. There was a protesting squeal and a sudden scramble of hoofed feet.
"Don't step on my peg,"
the bleary-eyed old Karan sitting at the table said belligerently.
"I don't step on your peg, do I?"
He pronounced it peg, and Geryon had a little trouble sorting out his dialect.
"What's your fate?"
the Karan said ominously.
"Fate?"
Geryon shrank back from that word just a bit.
Fate! Them things you got on the end of your legs?
Oh, feet.
That's what I just said. Fate.
Sorry, Geryon apologized. I didn't quite understand.
That's the trouble with you Outlanders. You can't even understand the language when she spoke to you plain as day.
Why don't we have a tankard of ale? Geryon suggested. I'll apologize to your pig just as soon as he comes back.
The Kurand squinted at him suspiciously. The old man was bearded, and he wore clothing made of poorly tanned furs. He wore a hat made from the whole skin of a badger, with the legs and tail still attached. He was very dirty, and Geryon could clearly see the fleas peeking out of his beard.
I'm buying, Geryon offered, sitting down across the table from the pig's owner.
The old Kurand's face brightened noticeably. They had a couple of tankards of ale together. Geryon noticed that the stuff had a raw green flavor to it, as if it had been dipped from the vat a week or so too soon. His host, however, smacked his lips and rolled his eyes, as if this were the finest brew in the world. Something cold and wet touched Geryon's hand, and he jerked it away. He looked down into a pair of earnest blue eyes, fenced in by bristly white eyelashes. The pig had recently been to the wallow, and he carried a powerful odor with him. The old Kurand chortled.
That's just my pig. He's a good-natured young pig, and he don't hold no grudges.
The fur-clad fellow blinked owlishly.
Hmm's an orphan, you know.
Oh?
His ma made real good bacon, though,
the old man snuffled, and wiped his nose on the back of his hand.
Sometimes I miss her real bad, he admitted.
He squinted at Geryon.
Say, that's a mighty big knife you got there.
Yes, Geryon agreed.
He absently scratched the half-grown pig's ears, and the animal closed his eyes in bliss, laid his head in Geryon's lap, and grunted contentedly.
We were coming down the trail out of the mountains, and we saw a lot of smoke out on the plain. Is there some kind of trouble out there?
The worst kind of trouble there is, friend, the old man said seriously.
He squinted at Geryon again.
You're not one of them Malorines, are you?
No, Geryon assured him. Not Malorian. I come from further west.
I didn't know there was anything to the west of the Malorines. Anyhow, there's whole bunches of people down there on the plains having some kind of an argument about religion.
Religion?
I don't hold much with it myself, the Kurand admitted. There's them as do, and them as don't. I'm one of them as don't. Let the gods take care of themselves, I say. I take care of me and mine. And we're quits on the whole business.
Seems like a good way, Geryon said carefully.
Glad you see it like that. Anyhow, there's this Grolem named Zendramas down in Dar Shiva. This Zendramas, she come up into Vorsebo and started talking about this here new god of Engarak, Torak being dead and all, you know. Now, I'm just about as interested in all that as my peg is. He's a smart peg, and he knows when people is talking nonsense.
Geryon patted the pig's muddy flank, and the plump little animal made an ecstatic sound.
Good pig, Geryon agreed. Peg, that is.
I'm fond of him. He's warm and good to snuggle up against on a cold night. Don't hardly snore none at all. Well, sir, this Zendramas, she come up there and started peaching and yelling, and I don't know what all. The Grolems all gives out a moan, falls down on their faces. Then a while back, a whole new bunch of Grolems comes over them mountains, and they says that this Zandramas is dead wrong. They says that there's going to be a new god over Angarak, right enough, but that this Zandramas don't have the straight of it. That's what all the smoke down there on the plains is about. Both sides is a-burning and a-kidding and a-preaching about their idea of who the new god's gonna be. I'm not gonna have anything to do with either side. Me and my Peg are gonna go back up in the mountains and let them folks kid each other. When they get it all sorted out, we'll come back and nod at whichever altar comes out on top as we go by.
You keep calling this Zandramas she, Garion noted.
Would you believe? It's a woman, the Karan snorted. That's the foolishest thing I ever heard tell of. Women got no business mixing up in men's affairs.
Have you ever seen her?
Like I say, I don't mess around in religious stuff. Me and my Peg, we're just kind of keep to ourselves when it comes to that.
A good way to get along, Garion said to him. My friends and I have to go through that plain down there, though. Are Grolems all we need to worry about?
I can see you're a stranger, the Karan said, suggestively looking down into his empty tankard.
Here, Garion said. Let's get another one. He fished another coin out of the pouch at his waist and signaled the serving man.
The whole thing, friend, the garrulous owner of the pig went on, is that in this part of the country, them's Grolems always has troops with them. The ones as follow Zandramas, they got the army of the king of Orseba with them. The old king, he didn't hold with none of this religious stuff, but he got hisself deposed. His son decided the old man was getting too silly to run the country, so set his pa aside and took the throne for hisself. The son's a squinty-eyed sort. He's looking to put hisself on the side most likely to win. He's throwed in with Zandramas. But then this Irvin fella, he comes along. He's got this whole army out of Genoa and Ganesia, and folks in armor and some really ugly big black dogs with him. Not to mention all the Grolems. It's mean down there on the plains, friend. They're killing and burning and sacrificing prisoners on this altar or that. If it was me, I'd go a long way around all that foolishness.
I wish I could, friend, Garion told him sincerely. We heard that there were demons up in Geno, off toward Kalida. Have any of them shown up around here?
Demons?
The Karan shuddered, making the sign against evil.
None that I ever heard tell of. If I had, me and my Peg would already be so far back in the mountains that they'd have to ship daylight into us by pack train.
Despite himself, Garion found that he liked this gabby old fellow. There was an almost musical flow to his illiterate speech, a kind of warm inclusiveness that paid no attention to any kind of social distinction, and a shrewd, even penetrating assessment of the chaos around him. It was almost with regret that Garion briefly acknowledged Silk's jerk of the head in the direction of the door. Gently, he removed the pig's head from his lap. The animal made a small, discontented sound.
"I'm afraid I'm going to have to go now," he told the Karan as he rose to his feet. "I thank you for your company, and the loan of your pig."
"Peg,"
the Karan corrected.
"Peg," Garion agreed.
He stopped the serving man who was going by and handed him a coin. "Give my friend and his Peg whatever they'd like," he said.
"Why, thank you, my young friend,"
the old Karan grinned expansively.
"My pleasure," Garion said. He looked down. "Have a nice day, Pig," he added.
The pig grunted rather distantly and clattered around the table to his master. Zinedra wrinkled her nose as he approached the shady spot where the ladies had been waiting.
"What on earth have you been doing, Garion? You smell awful."
"I was getting acquainted with a pig."
"A pig?"
she exclaimed.
Whatever for?
You almost had to have been there.
As they rode along, exchanging the information they had gleaned, it became evident that the owner of the pig had offered a surprisingly complete and succinct perception of the situation in Vorosebo. Garrigan repeated the conversation, complete with dialect.
He didn't really talk that way, did he?
Velvet giggled incredulously.
Why, no'm, Garrigan said, exaggerating just a bit. When you get right down to the core of it, he didn't. There was theses and thoses and themses that I can't quite get the hang of. Me and the pig got along good, though.
Garrigan, Polgaroy said a bit distantly, do you suppose you could ride back there a ways? She gestured toward the rear of the column. Several hundred yards or so, I should say.
Yes, ma'am, he said.
He ran Chrétien in. The big gray horse, he noted, also seemed a bit offended by something in the air. By general request, Garrigan bathed that night in a shockingly cold mountain stream. When he returned, shivering, to the fire, Bulgareth looked at him and said,
I think you had better put your armor back on. If half of what your friend with the pig said is true, you might need it.
Peg, Garrigan corrected.
What?
Never mind.
The next morning dawned clear and definitely chilly. The mail coat felt clammy, even through the padded tunic Garrigan always wore under it, and it was heavy and uncomfortable. Durnick cut him a lance from a nearby thicket and leaned it against a tree near where the horses were picketed. Pelgarath came back from a small hilltop where he had been surveying the plains below.
From what I can see, the turmoil is fairly general down there, so there isn't much point in trying to avoid people. The quicker we get past Vorosebo, the better, so we might as well ride straight on through. We'll try to talk our way out of any difficulties first, and if that does not work, we will do it the other way.
I suppose I'd better go find another club, Tzadi sighed.
They rode out with Garrigan jingling along in the lead. His helmet was in place, and his shield was strapped to his left arm. The butt of his lance rested beside his foot in his stirrup, and he affected a menacing scowl. The sword, strapped across his back, pulled steadily at him, indicating that they were still on the trail of Zandramas. When they reached the edge of the foothills, the winding mountain track became a narrow, rutted road, stretching off toward the southeast. They picked up their pace and moved along the road at a brisk trot. A few miles out onto the plain, they passed a burning village set back about a half mile from the road. They did not stop to investigate. About noon, they encountered a party of armed men on foot. There were about 15 of them, and they wore clothing which vaguely resembled uniforms.
Well, Garrigan said back over his shoulder, tightening his grip on his lance.
Let me talk to them first, Silk said, moving his horse forward. Try to look dangerous.
The little man walked his horse toward the strangers.
You're blocking the road, he told them in an unfriendly tone.
We have orders to check everyone who passes,
one of them said, looking at Garrigan a little nervously.
All right. You have checked us. Now, stand aside.
Which side are you on?
Now, that's a stupid question, man,
Silk replied. Which side are you on?
I don't have to answer that.
Then neither do I. Use your eyes, man. Do I look like a Karand, or a temple guardsman, or a Grolem?
Do you follow Irvan or Zandramas?
Neither one. I follow money, and you don't make money by getting mixed up in religion.
The roughly dressed soldier looked even more uncertain.
I have to report which side you are on to my captain.
That's assuming that you have seen me, Silk told him, bouncing a purse suggestively on the palm of his hand. I am in a hurry, friend. I have no interest in your religion. Please, do me the same courtesy.
The soldier was looking at the purse in Silk's hand with undisguised greed.
It would be worth quite a bit to me, not to be delayed, Silk suggested slyly.
He theatrically wiped his brow.
It's getting hot out here, he said. Why don't you and your men go find some shade to rest in? I'll accidentally drop this purse here, and you can find it later. That way you make a nice profit, and I get to move along without interference, and without having someone in authority find out that I have passed.
"'Tis getting warm out here, the soldier agreed.
I thought you might have noticed that.
The other soldiers were grinning openly.
You won't forget to drop the purse?
Oh, trust me, Silk said.
The soldiers trooped across the field toward a grove of trees. Silk negligently tossed the purse into the ditch beside the road and motioned for the others to come ahead.
We might want to move right along, he suggested.
Another purse full of pebbles, Dernick grinned.
No, Dernick. The purse has real money in it. Malorian brass halfpennies. You can't buy very much with them, but they're real money, right enough.
What if he'd asked to see what was inside?
Silk grinned and held up his cupped hand. Tightly wedged between the folds of the skin in his palm were several silver coins.
I like to be ready for eventualities, he said.
Then he looked back over his shoulder.
I think we should leave now. The soldiers are coming back to the road.
The next encounter was a bit more serious. Three temple guardsmen blocked the road. Their shields were in front of them. Their lances were at the ready. Their faces were devoid of thought.
My turn, Garion said, settling his helmet more firmly in place and shifting his shield.
He lowered his lance and thumped Kretchen with his heels. As he charged, he could hear another horse pounding along behind him. But he did not have time to look back. It was all so stupid. But he felt that surge in his blood again.
Idiocy, he muttered.
Then he easily unhorsed the guardsman in the center. Dernick, he noted, had cut his lance perhaps 2 feet longer than was standard. With a quick flick of his shield, he deflected the lances of the other two guardsmen and thundered on between them. Kretzen's hooves slammed down into the still tumbling body of the fallen guardsman. Garion reined in sharply and whirled the big gray to face the two he had left behind. But there was no need. The man riding behind him was Toth, and the two guardsmen had already tumbled limply from their saddles.
I could find work for you in Arendia, Toth, he said to the huge man. Somewhere there has to be someone to convince them that they're not invincible.
Toth grinned at him in a soundless laugh. Central Versebo was in total chaos. Pillars of smoke rose from burning villages and farms. Crops had been put to the torch, and bands of armed men savagely attacked each other. One such skirmish was taking place in a burning field, and both sides were caught up in such a frenzy that they paid no attention to the wall of flame sweeping down on them. Mutilated bodies seemed to be everywhere, and there was no way Garion could shield Sinedra from the horrors littering the ditches and even the road itself. They galloped on. As dusk descended over the stricken countryside, Dernick and Toth turned aside from the road to seek shelter for the night. They returned to report that they had discovered a low thicket lying in a gully a mile or so back from the road.
We won't be able to build any fires, Dernick said soberly. But if we stay fairly quiet, I don't think anybody's going to find us.
The night was not pleasant. They took a cold supper in the thicket and tried for what scant shelter they could make out of what was available, since they could not erect their tents in the dense brush. Autumn was in the air, and it was cold. Once the sky turned dark. As the first light of dawn touched the eastern horizon, they rose, ate a hasty breakfast, and rode on. The cold, miserable night and the senseless slaughter all around them made Garion angry, and he grew angrier with each passing mile. About mid-morning he saw a black-robed Grolem standing beside an altar several hundred yards out in a field, to the right of the road. A band of roughly dressed soldiers were dragging three terrified villagers toward the altar by ropes tied about the victims' necks. Garion did not even stop to think. He discarded his lance, drew Iron Grip's sword, cautioned the orb to avoid display, and then charged. The Grolem was apparently so caught up in his religious frenzy that he neither heard nor saw Garion bearing down on him. He screamed once as Kretchen thundered over the top of him. The soldiers took one startled look at Garion, threw away their weapons, and fled. That did not seem to satisfy his anger, however. Implacably, he pursued them. His anger was not so great, though, as to goad him into killing unarmed men. Instead, he simply rode them down one by one. When the last had tumbled beneath the big gray's hooves, Garion wheeled, freed the prisoners, and cantered back to the road.
"Don't you think that was a little excessive?" Belgareth demanded angrily.
"Not under the circumstances, no," Garion snapped back. "At least I'm fairly sure that one group of soldiers in this stinking country won't be dragging civilians to the altar, at least not until all of the broken bones mend."
Belgareth snorted in disgust and turned away. Still enraged, Garion glared belligerently at Polgara.
"Well?" he demanded.
"I didn't say anything, dear," she said mildly. "Next time, though, don't you think you should let your grandfather know what you are planning? These little surprises set his teeth on edge sometimes."
Belden came flaring in.
"What happened out there?"
he asked curiously, when he had resumed his own form. He pointed at the groaning soldiers dotting the nearby field.
"My horse needed some exercise," Garion said flatly. "Those soldiers got in his way."
"What's got you so foul-tempered this morning?"
"This is all so stupid."
"Of course it is. But get ready for some more of it. The border of Rengel is just ahead, and things are just as bad down there as they are here."
Chapter 3 They paused at the border to consider their alternatives. The guard post at the boundary was deserted, but black columns of smoke rose from burning villages, and they could clearly see large groups of men moving across the landscape, looking tiny in the distance.
"Things are a little more organized down here," Belden reported. "About all we saw in Vorsebo were fairly small bands. They were more interested in loot than fighting. The groups are bigger on up ahead, and there's a certain semblance of discipline. I don't think we'll be able to bluff our way through Rengel the way we did Vorsebo."
Toth made a series of obscure gestures.
"What did he say?" Belgareth asked Durnick.
"He suggests that we travel at night," Durnick replied.
"That's an absurd notion, Toth," Thadi protested. "If things are dangerous in the daytime, they'll be 10 times more dangerous at night."
Toth's hands began to move again. For some reason, Garion found that he could almost understand what the huge mute was trying to say.
"He says that you looked at the idea too fast, Thadi," Durnick translated. "We've got certain advantages."
The smith frowned slightly, and he looked back at his friend.
"How did you find out about that?"
he asked. Toth gestured again.
"Oh," Durnick nodded. "I guess she would know, wouldn't she?"
He turned to the others.
"He says that Belgareth, Paul, and Garion can lead the way in their other forms. The darkness wouldn't be that big a problem for a pair of wolves and an owl."
Belgareth tugged thoughtfully at one earlobe.
"It's got possibilities," he said to Belden. "We could avoid just about anybody out there that way. Soldiers don't move around in the dark very much." "They post sentries, though,"
the hunchback pointed out.
"Garion, Paul, and I would not have much trouble locating them, and leading the rest of you around them.
It's going to be slow going,
Velvet said.
We won't be able to travel at a gallop, and we'll have to detour around every sentry we come across.
You know, Silk said, now that I think about it, it's not such a bad idea. I sort of like it.
You always enjoy sneaking around in the dark, Keldar,
Velvet said to him.
Oh, don't you?
Well,
then she smiled at him.
I suppose I do. Yes. But then, I'm a Drasnian too.
It would take too long,
Zinedra protested.
We're only a little way behind Zandramas. If we try to sneak, she'll get ahead again.
I don't see that we've got much choice, Zinedra,
Geryon told her gently.
If we just try to plow our way across Wrangel, sooner or later we're going to run into more soldiers than we can handle.
You are a sorcerer,
she said accusingly.
You could wave your hand and just knock them out of our way.
There are limits to that, Zinedra,
Polgara said. Both Zandramas and Urvon have Grolems in the region. If we tried to do it that way, everybody in Wrangel would know exactly where we were.
Zinedra's eyes filled with tears, and her lower lip began to tremble. She turned and ran blindly away from the road, sobbing.
Go after her, Geryon, Polgara said. See if you can get her calmed down.
They took shelter for the rest of the day in a grove of beech trees about a mile from the road. Geryon tried to sleep, knowing that the night ahead of them would be very long, but after about an hour, he gave up and wandered restlessly about the camp. He shared Zinedra's impatience. They were so close to Zandramas now, and moving at night would slow their pace to a crawl. Try though he might, however, he could think of no alternative. As the sun was going down, they struck camp and waited at the edge of the beech grove for it to get dark.
I think I've just hit a flaw in the plan, Silk said.
Oh? Belgarath asked.
We need the orb to be able to follow Zandramas. If Geryon turns into a wolf, the orb won't be able to tell him which way to go. Or will it?
Belgarath and Belden exchanged a long look.
I don't know, Belgarath admitted. Do you?
I haven't got the slightest idea, Belden said.
Well, there's only one way to find out, Geryon said.
He handed Kretchen's reins to Durnik and went some distance away from the horses. Carefully, he created the image of the wolf in his mind. Then he began to focus his will upon the image. He seemed, as always, to go through a peculiar sensation of melting, and then it was done. He sat on his haunches for a moment, checking himself over to make sure everything was there. His nose suddenly caught a familiar fragrance. He turned his head and looked back over his shoulder. Zinedra stood there, her eyes very wide, and the fingertips of one hand to her lips.
Is that still really you, Geryon?
She stammered. He rose to his feet and shook himself. There was no way he could answer her. Human words would not fit in the mouth of a wolf. Instead, he padded over to her and licked her hand. She sank to her knees, wrapped her arms about his head, and laid her cheek against his muzzle.
Oh, Geryon,
she said in a tone of wonder. On an impulse born out of sheer mischief, he deliberately licked her face from chin to hairline. His tongue was quite long, and quite wet.
Stop that,
she said, giggling in spite of herself, and trying to wipe her face. He momentarily touched his cold nose to the side of her neck. She flinched away. Then he turned and loped off toward the road where the trail was. He paused in the bushes beside the road and carefully peered out, his ears alert, and his nose searching for the scent of anyone in the vicinity. Then, satisfied, he slipped out of the bushes with his belly low to the ground to stand in the middle of the road. It was not the same, of course. There was a subtle difference to the pulling sensation. but it was still there. He felt a peculiar satisfaction and had to restrain an urge to lift his muzzle in a howl of triumph. Then he turned and loped back toward where the others were hidden. His toenails dug into the turf, and he exulted in a wild sense of freedom. It was almost with regret that he changed back into his own shape. "Well?" Belgarath asked as he walked toward them in the gathering dusk.
"No problem,"
Geryon replied, trying to sound casual about it. He suppressed the urge to grin, knowing that his offhand manner would irritate his grandfather enormously.
"Are you really sure we need him along on this trip?"
Belgarath asked his daughter.
Yes, father," she said. "He is sort of necessary."
"I was afraid you might feel that way about it."
He looked at the others.
"All right. This is the way it works. Paul and Durnick can keep in touch with each other over quite some distance. So he will be able to warn you if we run across any soldiers, or if the trail moves off the road. Move at a walk to keep down the noise, and be ready to take cover on short notice. Geryon, keep your mind in contact with Paul's, and don't forget that you've got a nose and ears, as well as eyes. Swing back to the road from time to time to make sure that we are still on the trail. Does anybody have any questions?"
They all shook their heads.
"All right, then. Let's go." "Do you want me to go along?"
Belden offered.
"Thanks all the same, Uncle,"
Bulgara declined.
"But hawks don't really see all that well in the dark. You would not be much help after you had flown head-on into a few trees."
It was surprisingly easy. The first impulse of any group of soldiers when setting up for the night is to build fires, and the second is to keep them going until the sun comes up. Guided by these cheery beacons, Geryon and Belgarath were able to locate the night encampments of all of the bands of troops in the area and to sniff out the sentries. As luck had it, in most cases the troops had set up some distance from the road, and the party was able to ride through undetected. It was well into the night. Geryon had crept to the top of a hill to survey the next valley. There were a fair number of campfires out there, winking at him in the darkness.
"Geryon?"
Tenedra's voice seemed right on top of him. With a startled yelp, he jumped high into the air. It took him a moment to regain his composure.
"Tenedra,"
he whined plaintively,
"please don't do that. You almost scared me out of my fur."
"I just wanted to be sure that you were all right,"
she said defensively.
"If I have to wear this amulet, I may as well get some use out of it."
"I'm fine, Tenedra," he said in a patient tone. "Just don't startle me like that. Wolves are edgy animals." "Children," Baldra's voice cut in firmly, "you can play some other time. I am trying to hear Durnick, and you are drowning him out with all of this chatter."
"Yes, Aunt Paul,"
Geryon replied automatically.
"I love you, Geryon,"
Tenedra whispered by way of farewell. They traveled by night, and sought cover as dawn began to stain the eastern sky for the next several days. It all became so easy that, finally, Geryon grew careless. He was padding through a thicket on the fourth night, and accidentally stepped on a dry twig.
"Who's there?"
The voice was downwind of him, and the soldier's scent had not reached his nostrils. The fellow came pushing into the thicket, making a great deal of noise. He was warily holding a spear out in front of him. Angry more at himself than at the clumsy sentry, Geryon shouldered the spear aside, raised up on his hind legs, and put his forepaws on the terrified man's shoulders. Then he swore at some length, his oaths coming out as horrid growling and snarling. The soldier's eyes bulged as Geryon's awful fangs snapped within inches of his face. Then he screamed and fled. Geryon slunk guiltily out of the thicket and loped away. Palgora's voice came to him.
"What was that?"
Nothing important, he replied, more than a little ashamed of himself. Tell Durnick and the others to swing out to the west for a while. This group of soldiers is camped fairly close to the road. It was nearly dawn on the following night, when the night breeze brought the smell of frying bacon to Geryon's nostrils. He crept forward through the tall grass, but before he could get near enough to see who was cooking, he encountered his grandfather.
"Who is it?"
he asked in the manner of wolves.
"A couple hundred soldiers," Belgarath replied, "and a whole herd of pack mules."
"They're right on the road, aren't they?"
"I don't think that's going to be a problem. I heard a couple of them talking. It seems that they work for Silk."
"Silk's got his own army?"
Geryon asked incredulously.
"So it would seem. I wish that little thief wouldn't keep secrets from me."
Geryon felt the old man's thought reaching out. "Paul, tell Durnick to send Silk up here." And then he looked at Geryon.
"Let's go back to the road. I want to have a little talk with the pride of Drasnia."
They loped back to the road, resumed their own shapes, and intercepted Silk. Belgarath, Geryon thought, showed enormous restraint.
"There's a large group of soldiers wearing blue tunics just up ahead," he said in a level tone. "Would you by any chance know who they are?"
"What are they doing here?" Silk asked with a puzzled frown. "They have been told to avoid any area where there's trouble."
"Maybe they didn't hear you."
Belgarath's tone was sarcastic.
"It's a standing order. I'm definitely going to talk with the captain about this."
"You've got a private army?"
Geryon asked the little man.
"Oh, I don't know that I'd call it an army, exactly. Yarblick and I hired some mercenaries to guard our caravans, is all."
"Isn't that terribly expensive?"
"Not nearly as expensive as losing those caravans would be. Highway robbery is a cottage industry in Karanda. Let's go talk with them."
"Why don't we?"
Belgarath's tone was flat, even unfriendly.
"You're not taking this very well, old friend."
"Don't crowd it, Silk. I have been slinking through wet grass for 5 nights running. I have got burrs in my coat and a snarl in my tail that is going to take me a week to chew out. And all this time you have had an armed escort within shouting distance."
"I didn't know they were there, Belgarath," Silk protested. "They're not supposed to be here."
Belgarath stalked away, muttering curses under his breath. The muleteers in the camp had begun to load their animals when Silk, with Geryon walking on one side of him and Belgarath on the other, rode in. A hard-bitten-looking man with a pockmarked face and thick wrists approached them and saluted.
"Your Highness," he said to Silk, "we didn't know that you were in this part of Meloria."
"I move around a lot," Silk said.
"Is it all right if we join you, Captain Rekos?"
"Of course, Your Highness."
"The rest of our party will be along shortly," Silk told him.
"What are we having for breakfast this morning?"
"Bacon, fried eggs, chops, hot bread, jam. The usual, Your Highness."
"No gruel?"
"I can have the cook mix some up for you if you would like, Your Highness," Rakos replied.
"No, thanks, Captain. I think I can live without gruel, for today anyway."
"Would Your Highness care to inspect the troops?"
Silk made a face and then sighed.
"Ah, they sort of expect it, don't they?"
"It's good for morale, Your Highness," Rakos assured him. "An uninspected trooper begins to feel unappreciated."
"Right you are, Captain," Silk said, dismounting. "Follow them in, if you would please, and I will boost their morale."
The captain turned and bellowed an order.
"Excuse me," Silk said to Belgarath and Geryon. "Certain formalities are the price of command."
He smoothed down his hair with the palm of his hand and carefully adjusted his clothing. Then he followed Captain Rekos toward the ranks of soldiers standing at attention beside the road. His manner was grand as he inspected his troops, and he rather meticulously pointed out missing buttons, unshaved faces, and boots not polished to perfection. Durnik, Polgara, and the others arrived while he was progressing down the last rank. Belgarath quickly explained the situation to them. When Silk returned, he had a certain self-satisfied look on his face.
"Was all that really necessary?"
Velvet asked him. "It's expected," he shrugged. He looked rather proudly at his men. "They look good, don't they? I may not have the biggest army in Meloria, but I have got the sharpest. Why don't we go have some breakfast?"
"I've eaten soldiers' rations before," Belden told him. "I think I'll go look for another pigeon."
"You're jumping to conclusions, Belden," the little man assured him. "Bad food is the greatest cause of dissatisfaction in the ranks of any army. Jarblik and I are very careful to hire only the best cooks, and to provide them with only the finest food available. Dry rations might be good enough for Kalazakath's army, but not for mine." Captain Rekos joined them for breakfast. Rekos was obviously a field soldier, and he had certain difficulties with his utensils. "Where's the caravan bound?" Silk asked him.
"Jarot, Your Highness."
"And what are we carrying?"
"Beans."
"Beans?" Silk sounded a little startled.
"It was your order, Your Highness," Rekos said. "Word came from your factor in Malzeth before the plague broke out that you wanted to corner the market in beans. Your warehouses in Megaren are overflowing with them, so lately we've been transferring them to Jarot."
"Why would I do that?" Silk said, scratching his head in bafflement. "Zakath was bringing his army back from Tol Murgos," Geryon reminded him. "He was going to mount a campaign in Coranda. You wanted to buy up all of the beans in Meloria so that you could gouge the Bureau of Military Procurement."
"Gouge is such an ugly word, Geryon," Silk protested with a pained look. He frowned. "I thought I had rescinded that order."
"Not that I've heard, Your Highness," Rekos said. "You have got tons of beans pouring into Megaren from all over Dershin and southern Genesia."
Silk groaned.
"How much longer is it going to take us to reach Jarot? I have got to put a stop to this."
"Several days, Your Highness," Rekos replied.
"And the beans will just keep piling up the whole time?"
"Probably, Your Highness."
Silk groaned again. They rode on down through the remainder of Wrangel with no further incidents. Silk's professional soldiers apparently had a wide reputation in the region, and the poorly trained troops of the varying factions there gave them a wide berth. Silk rode at the head of the column like a field marshal, looking about with a lordly manner.
"Are you going to let him get away with that?"
Zenedra asked Velvet after a day or so.
"Of course not,"
Velvet replied.
"But let him enjoy it for now. Time enough to teach him the realities of the situation later on."
"You're terrible,"
Zenedra giggled.
"Naturally. But didn't you do the same thing to our hero here?"
Velvet looked pointedly at Geryon.
"Lysel,"
Polgara said firmly, "you are giving away secrets again."
"Sorry, Lady Polgara,"
Velvet replied contritely. The trail of Zandramas was soon joined by the sullen scarlet trail of the Sardian, and both proceeded down across Wrangel to the river Kalahar and the border of Selanta. The trails also seemed to be going toward Jarot.
"Why is she going toward the sea?"
Geryon worriedly asked Belgarath.
"Who knows?" the old man replied shortly. "She has read the Ashabin oracles, and I have not. It could be that she knows where she is going, and I'm just floundering along in the rear."
"But what if—"
"Please, don't what if me, Geryon," Belgarath said. "I've got enough problems already."
They crossed the river Kalahar aboard a cluster of ferries that seemed to belong to Silk and arrived in the port city of Jarot on the Tselanta side. As they rode through the cobbled streets, crowds came out to cheer. Silk rode at the head of the column, graciously waving his acknowledgment of the cheers.
Have I missed something? Durnik asked.
His people love him very much,
Eriond explained. His people?
Who owns a man, Durnik?
The blonde young man asked sadly.
The one who rules him, or the one who pays him?
Silk's offices in Geralt were opulent, even ostentatious. Malorian carpets lay thick upon the floors. The walls were paneled in rare polished wood, and officials in costly livery were everywhere.
One sort of has to keep up appearances, the little man explained apologetically as they entered. The natives are so impressed by show.
Of course, Belgarath said dryly.
Oh, surely you don't think...
Just let it pass, Silk.
But it's all so much fun, Belgarath,
Silk grinned. Belgarath then did something Geryon had never thought he would see him do. He raised his hands imploringly, assumed a tragic expression, and said,
Why me?
Belden chortled.
Well, Belgarath said crossly to him. Nothing, Belden replied.
Silk's factor in Geralt was a baggy-eyed Malcine named Kasvor. Kasvor walked as if he had the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he sighed often. He came wearily into the office where Silk sat as if enthroned behind a very large writing desk, and the rest of them lounged in comfortable chairs along the walls.
"Prince Kaldar," Kasvor said, bowing.
"Ah, Kasvor," Silk said.
"I've seen to the rooms your highness wanted," Kasvor sighed. "The inn is called the Lion. It's two streets over. I've taken the entire top floor for you."
Durnik leaned over and whispered to Geryon.
"Wasn't that inn we stayed at in Kamar also called the Lion? The place where Brendig arrested us that time."
"I'd imagine that you could find a lion inn in just about every city in the world," Geryon replied.
"Capital, Kasvor, capital," Silk was saying.
Kasvor smiled faintly.
"How's business?"
"We're showing a fair profit, your highness."
"How fair?"
"About 45%.
"Not bad. I need to talk to you about something else, though. Let's stop buying beans."
"I'm afraid it's a little late for that, your highness. We own just about every bean in Meloria already."
Silk groaned and buried his face in his hands.
"The market is up 10 points, though, your highness."
"It is?"
Silk sounded startled, and his eyes brightened.
"How did that happen?"
"There have been all manner of rumors going about, and some tentative inquiries from the Bureau of Military Procurement. Everyone's been scrambling around trying to buy up beans, but we've got them all."
10 points, you say?"
"Yes, your highness."
"Sell,"
Silk said. Kasvor looked startled.
"We bought up the bean crop in the expectation of an imperial military campaign in Karanda. There won't be one now."
"Can your highness be sure?"
"I have access to certain sources of information. When the word gets out, the market in beans is going to sink like a rock. And we don't really want several million tons of beans on our hands, do we? Have there been any offers?"
"The Malcine Consortium has expressed some interest, your highness. They're willing to go 2 points above the market."
"Negotiate with them, Kasvor. When they get to 3 points above the market price, sell. I don't want to have to eat all of those beans myself."
"Yes, your highness."
Belgarath cleared his throat meaningfully. Silk glanced at the old man and nodded.
"We just came down through Vorosebo and Wrangel. Things are a bit chaotic up there."
So I've heard, Your Highness, Kasvor replied. Is there unrest anywhere else in the region? We have some things to do in this part of the world, and we don't want to have to do them in a war zone if we don't have to. Kasvor shrugged. Darshiva's in an uproar. But there's nothing new about that. Darshiva's been in an uproar for the past 12 years. I took the liberty of pulling all of our people out of that principality. There's nothing left there that's worth our while.
He looked toward the ceiling in mock piety.
Ah, may Zandramas grow a boil on her nose, he prayed.
Amen, Sulk agreed fervently. Is there any place else we ought to avoid?
I've heard that northern Gandahar is a bit nervous, Kasvor answered. But that doesn't affect us, since we don't deal in elephants.
Smartest decision we ever made, Silk said to Belgarath. Do you have any idea how much an elephant can eat?
Beldane is also reported to be in turmoil just now, Your Highness, Kasvor reported. Zandramas is spreading her infection in all directions.
Have you ever seen her? Silk asked him.